ball is high, it is far, it is gone to win the game.
The Mets are on their way back.
World champions for the 27th time.
Home plate for all things Major League Baseball. This is the Nosebleeds Podcast on WFUV Sports.
Welcome back to another episode of Nosebleeds, WFUV's number one podcast for all things Major League Baseball, New York and beyond. I am Jack Warner, joined alongside by Barrett Spritzer. Soon enough, we'll have Lou Orlando in here as he makes his way in and out. But I think it's just kind of fun to list off the crew today because after every single availability issue imaginable, we're here at the end of the week getting an episode in right at the buzzer. So Barrett, how you doing? And I think it's just, we're safe to say we're lucky that we're even getting this video filmed.
I think this probably encapsulates 4th of July weekend for everyone. Just people dropping off left and right. Who knows what's going on? We do end up with a 3-man crew. Who knows? We might end up with 5 at some point if people hop on. But I'm ready to talk some baseball.
Yeah, see if people just kind of, maybe people just spontaneously spawn into the show. I mean, maybe that's what all these availability issues would maybe lead up to. But no, there's plenty to unpack from, obviously, the tri-state. A lot of different stories between the Yankees and Mets, which is really going to be the primary focus of today's episode as we head closer and closer to a much-needed all-star break, I think, for both squads, even though both teams are in much different positions. Any team that is going through kind of a gauntlet in whatever way that may be always is in some way looking forward to the all-star break. I do want to start with the Bronx Bombers, the New York Yankees, who I'm going to be honest, probably are. What can you say about the past month or so that the Yankees have had considering the historic start to a season that we saw from them that saw them just short of 30 games above 500. And going into yesterday's game against the Red Sox, which we'll get into, which I'm sure Yankees faithful near and far are very, very, very happy. The Yankees were 5-15 in their last 20 games. And it starts with a series on the road against the Red Sox back in, early June, where they drop 2 out of 3 at Fenway. They go on to lose a series against the Orioles, then lose a series against the Braves, then lose a full series to the Mets, then split a series with Toronto, then get swept by Cincinnati, and then today, they have a chance to finally win a series for the first time in just about a month. So, you look at such a dominant team that really did look like the World Series favorite to open up this year. I got to ask, Barrett, when you look at this past month or so of Yankees baseball, that, for lack of a better phrase, has been uncharacteristic. What do you think has just been the biggest thing that stood out to you as to why it's been such a rough month or so?
I think if I had one word to describe what the June and into early July Yankees have been, it's just uninspired, both on both sides of the baseball, right? The pitching that had been so historic and so great without Cole has kind of tapered off, right? Which with some young arms and some guys you're asking to step into some big roles early on in the season is expected. You see that a lot of the time, but just the bullpen hasn't been great. The fielding has been just lack of effort, and the hitting has been just otherworldly bad besides from, those top two guys. And I think when you're a team that relies so heavily on two guys to get everything done, which I guess in retrospect is better than what the Yankees have been in the past when it's just been the Judge show, but when it's just Judge and Soto, and now everyone else has just been completely horrendous and, 4A baseball players all the way throughout the lineup. It's just a team that I don't think could need the All-Star break to come any faster anymore. And it's a team where going into the All-Star break, they're going to have to look and say, hey, who is replaceable? Who can we kick out and really get replacements at the trade deadline? But also, who needs to just step up and because you got guys like Rizzo and Glaber and even Volpe at this point, who's had a really horrendous month, and they're guys who, if this team is going to contribute, is going to go far in the playoffs. They're guys who have to contribute and can't, you know, you can't rely on them to be 700 OPS guys and just kind of limp in and say, "Hey, Judge, I need you to hit a home run every game or we're not going to win."
Well, at the perfect timing, Lou Orlando has rejoined us. He has come back into my room as we are sharing a laptop as we record this. Lou, I think you're the perfect guy to toss this over to. Let's take yesterday's curb stomping of Boston out of the equation, because that's something we're going to get to in a few minutes. Just talking about the time leading up to Boston.
Barry, I really want to work off what you said, because I mean, you look at the 20 game stretch where it was a 5-15 record and the sky was falling. That's not a short enough blip where you can just go, "Hey man, that's baseball," and move on from it. You've seen enough here where, all right, you know, maybe that Alex Verdugo is not going to hit this poorly the rest of the season, or Volpe's not going to hit this poorly the rest of the season. You saw enough in this stretch to go, we probably need some type of fallback or some type of safety plan in case this happens again. And you know, we could talk about yesterday, they might not be out of it. One game is one game. I'm hesitant to say that, all right, we're on to greener pastures so far. I kind of want to see how the next week until the All-Star game pans out. The Giancarlo Stanton injury ended up being a bigger blow than I think got credit at the time. When you look at how well he was hitting and the safety that he provided Soto and Judge behind him, even Rizzo to some extent, just because he's a pro. And now you're faced with all these questions where it's, do we need to add a corner infielder? Because whether or not Ben Rice is the guy, DJ LeMayo is still not hitting. Do you believe that Rizzo's going to hit when he comes back? Do you want another outfielder in the mix? Do you trust Alex Verdugo? Do you trust that Stanton's going to come back and be healthy? That's a really tough thing to bank on. Do you want to add a catcher? And then, you know, we could talk about, do you need another arm? You probably do need bullpen guys. I think that's the least doubt question in my mind, is you need to add to this bullpen, but do you need another starter just in case? That the one good thing is that happened before All-Star break. A lot of times you see the Yankees collapse after, where now they've got time to sit back and go, all right, what's the biggest priority for us? Because I don't think that you can look at this 20-game stretch and go, it means nothing. I think you can look at it and go, we're probably not going to be that bad consistently. The same way I think hitting is contagious, I think not hitting is contagious, and just playing poorly is contagious. You're seeing that now. But that's baseball, and that's happened to the Yankees before in the postseason. So what are you going to do to make sure it doesn't happen this year?
And I think the other thing that stood out to me the most, and again, like I said, was not the case yesterday against Boston, because everything went right for the Yankees yesterday against Boston. But I think the one thing that stood out to me the most over this month, besides pitchers in the bullpen and in the starting rotation royally blowing it, is I have rarely seen such a good baseball team, an objectively good team on paper, have so little energy and so little firepower once you get past the 4 and 5 spot in the batting order. I mean, you are watching games where your only hope over the stretch, where your only hope of scoring runs was in the top three, top four hitters of that batting order. You get towards the bottom of the order and you have Trevino, who's not really having the season he would have hoped for. You have Volpe, who's having a rougher month than, you know, having one of the roughest months of his career, got moved down in the order somewhat recently. You have, you know, multiple LeMahieu, who's been a hard watch at multiple times throughout this stretch, for both performance reasons and, I'm going to be honest, hustle-based reasons. So I think one of the things that just blew me away was that a team that at some points was sniffing being 30 games over 500, like close to it, getting in the mid-20s over 500, had such a lopsided batting order for the past month. Because I don't think, even if the pitching had been better, if the bullpen had been sharper, if the starting rotation, if Rodon had been better, if certain pitchers weren't struggling the way they were, if you took some of the other pieces of this stuck pie that was the past, call it, you know, 20 games before yesterday, I think even if you took out some of the other factors that made them bad, I still think this month is almost just as bad, maybe slightly a little bit better, but still really bad, just with how dormant majority of the batting.
Take a look at how Wednesday's game against the Reds went. Carlos Rodon lets up three runs, and it feels like a backbreaker. And when he lets up that second home run, which is the two-run shot, and they go down 3-0, like that feels like a stab in the abs, a stab in the back, whatever metaphor you want to use. And it felt like one that the Yankees couldn't get back from. And they end up losing that game by one because they had a couple late rallies against the Reds. But yeah, the offense is in a weird spot. And I was talking to Will Talon, who's one of our other Yankees guys, about it's kind of funny the narrative around the Yankees lineup, the way that it shifted. When you think about where it was 4 years ago, where it was they were almost too power heavy. They had all those righties. And it was all home run or swing or miss is kind of the narrative around the lineup. Now it feels like they've gone almost the entire opposite way, where with Stanton out of the lineup, where's the power in this lineup coming from outside of Judge or Soto? I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing to go in this in the direction of let's get a balanced lineup, let's get more contact guys in there. Like I think Volpe will eventually project into a really nice hitter. I don't think it's bad to have a guy like Jose Trevino or Austin Wells in the bottom of your lineup. I actually really like Wells' swing. He's worked some really nice at bats. Mm-hmm. But with where DJ's power is right now, where he's struggling to get extra base hits, and you just look up and down the lineup, and it's just it's really, really tough to envision a huge fear factor in this lineup past Soto Judge, especially with standout. And so that's something that this team's going to have to overcome. I don't know if that power bat's out there for them. Like, are you getting Vlad? Are you getting Alonso? To me, that doesn't feel like the move that Brian Cashman's going to make. So you have to sit here and go, is there a hitter that we can get that sparks this lineup in some kind of way?
But I guess you would probably be the person to ask about this, I guess, then. Do you think that there's anyone else in the farm system that is necessarily someone that you think would be an MLB-ready bat, anyone that's been to spring training yet or went to spring training with the big league squad and has seen major league pitching before you make the big hop to making a ballsy move at the deadline for somebody? Is there, I'm not saying that necessarily the safest option or the most, you know, competitive option is always to necessarily pull up from your farm system, because again, they're still on the farm for a reason. But I don't know. Is this one of those seasons where they're 20 games over 500? This is a World Series or bust kind of year that they're in the midst of this struggling. I don't know if this year is an appropriate year where you get expensive at the deadline or you get ballsy at the deadline, even if it means in the following couple of years it causes some impact.
The thing you have to mull over here is, right now, you only have Soto for 1 year. And so you have to look at that as this is a one-year winning period, not for nothing, maybe not at the expense of our future entirely, but you do everything possible to try and win a World Series. So even with Ben Rice up here right now, like seeing Ben Rice get run is really cool. I think that's valuable. And so far, it's worked out. You still don't know what that's going to look like come postseason. I mean, not for nothing, Aaron Judge that first year when he came up and broke into the league had a really tough 2017 postseason, and they lost for a multitude of factors, but Judge was probably not the same hitter in the regular season that he was in the postseason. It's really tough with rookies to project how are you going to hit when the game changes. The same way that in other sports, the game changes when you get to the playoffs. I think baseball, the game changed a little bit. The teams get better, the pitching gets better. So I don't know if Ben Rice is going to be a guy they trust in the lineup to begin with. So like, in the system, there's a guy, Jorbit Vivas, that big baby Daniel John Boy was tweeting about. He's hitting 368 with an 838 OPS his last 16 games in AAA. Like, do you give him some run? We've seen the Yankees give run to guys that were in AAA that have been raking. I've heard the Esteban Florio story a million times. I've heard the Oswald Peraza story a million times when he crushes you in AAA. You just don't know how it's going to translate to the big leagues. And so I'd be hesitant to say put your eggs in the basket of someone internally being the long-term solution when we've seen that story time and time again of just wait, there's going to be an answer here. And you just don't know.
I think the biggest thing with the Yankees is, as you mentioned, you know, Juan Soto is only there for 1 year. So, you know, the front office knows better than we do, obviously. kind of where Soto's head is at. And maybe if they think they have Soto in the bag and that they can bring him back, they don't go all out. But when you have, you know, a guy like Soto paired with, you know, the franchise and Aaron Judge, you have to do everything you can to win. And I think this is maybe a time where you might see the front office decide, hey, this team isn't where it needs to be to compete. And so they go out, you know, way before, you know, and they go in into this All-Star break saying, hey, we're coming out of the All-Star break with someone new, someone who we think can contribute. And they might, you know, their trade deadline might start a couple weeks early because they decide that this is the way that the team has been going is not something that they can continue if they think that they are the team that they are as a World Series contender.
There's a lot to be desired. There's a lot of mystery going forward, especially because this has been a scary stretch of Yankees baseball to watch for Yankee fans. But I do want to pivot to a more positive note. And that was yesterday. I say this with a Red Sox pennant above my head in the camera right now. So I will try to sound as fake positive about this as I possibly can. No, I'll be honest. I was there yesterday, and it was quite a sight to see because Yankees rookie Ben Rice, Benjamin Arroz, as I like to call him, hit three home runs and became the first rookie in the history of the New York Yankees to hit three or more home runs in a game as the Yankees absolutely pummeled the Red Sox 14-4 at Yankee Stadium. A much, much needed win after the disaster that was Friday night when the Yankees had Boston down to their final strike in the ninth inning and cardiac Clay Holmes gives up an absolute bomb to Masataka Yoshida to tie the game. And then the Red Sox would go on to win in extras. But that was not the case on Saturday because you saw top to bottom, the whole lineup hitting. You saw some small ball. You saw some bunting. You saw Alex Verdugo taking the Red Sox deep again, hit a nice little frozen rope into Monument Park. But the story of the game was rookie Ben Rice having a hat trick home run day. Mm-hmm. Barrett, I want to get your thoughts on that. Just seeing a kid that's brand new to the show, that's really called up as more of a placeholder after Rizzo goes down with an injury, getting to see him sort of become more and more comfortable in his at-bats over the first couple weeks he's had in the league, to see him, you know, just absolutely lift off against the Yankees' most hated rival in front of a sold-out Yankee Stadium crowd. What were your thoughts of just seeing that yesterday?
I mean, I don't think there's any other sport in the world where you get poetic justice moments like that that you do in baseball. I mean, against the Boston Red Sox of all teams, you know, this guy who just come up, and for him to be kind of just get that moment. You saw the video of him with his curtain call, not knowing where to go, and it's just – that, I think, kind of encapsulates, you know, when he got his first hit and he couldn't stop smiling. You know, it's just so awesome to see a guy like that, you know, maybe be able to catalyze this team down the stretch. And just he is, you know, what Yankees baseball is. You know, they're the guy, you know, they are the brand. And so to see a guy like this come up and be able to do that for and just kind of show, like, this is what baseball is. And then, you know, in a rivalry game on 4th of July weekend, it's just – it is sign of good things to come, I think. And it's just so awesome to see what baseball can do for people and the joy that it can bring. And to see that, it's just incredible.
And Lou, I wanted to pass it over to you on this note, which I kind of took away from Rice's performance yesterday. Was I mentioned it in the post-game video that Yankee Stadium can sometimes allow you to get away with some home runs that you may not earn in every ballpark. The short porch is real. And it benefits both teams that are playing. But what I think impressed me the most about all three of Ben's homers yesterday, you had one that was 390, and then you had two of them that were over 400 feet. But all of them were absolute steeds. It wasn't some cheap hit a pop fly that hung long enough. We're talking low 100 to 110 exit below on every single homer.
Well, and he's gotten credit for the quality at bats that he's put together since he came up, and the broadcast did a lot of, you know, you think about when he came up, there was a lot of lefties that he had to go and face. It was a big lefty land. The Yankees were worried, should we call him up? They called him up, they gave him everyday run, and he hung in there. He didn't look overmatched. but we never really saw him consistently at bat after at bat drive the ball like this. So that's awesome to see from him. Like, if that, he's not going to hit 3 home runs every day, but if you can see this power stroke be a little bit more of a consistent presence for him, then who knows? Maybe that is the solution at first base for Anthony Rizzo long term. I mean, Luke Voit's probably not the best comp because it feels like he fizzled out for 3 years, but no one thought when Luke Voit came up in 2018 in the fall when he started to hit that couple weeks that he was going to be their starting first baseman for the next 2-3 years.
True.
Ended up being that for the next 2-3 years. So, like, who knows? Maybe this is the start of a really fun career for Ben Rice. I think it's awesome that he got to do this against Boston. You know, he's a Boston guy, played baseball.
Yes, he does.
Pod area. And it's kind of funny how much the vibes can change in a single day when you think about less than 24 hours later, after the worst loss of the season, to see Ben Rice and almost, I want to say, like, that youthful innocence, that youthful exuberance,
yeah,
that it felt like carried not just throughout the dugout, but throughout the entire stadium as you were watching. He's not a baby. He's like 25, but he looks like a baby. I mean, he looks like he's 12 years old. To see that joy just kind of spread through the stadium. And it kind of reminds you, like, our emotions with this team and probably the emotions within that locker room are very dependent on the outcome of each game. And that's how much the emotion can swing. And that's why managers harp on staying level and staying within the throes of the season. It's really hard to do. It's really hard to zoom out from a 20-game span like that and go, hey, tomorrow we could be okay. I think that's the perfect reminder, though. It just takes one game, and all of a sudden, think about how Yankee fans are feeling right now. Right. Again, it doesn't take away from the long-term concerns that you saw in that 20-game stretch, but it takes you out of the gutter.
The other thing that I think is huge for Ben Rice having the game that he had yesterday is you think about how young he is. You also think about all the conversations that we had, you know, earlier in this episode about one, you know, what direction are the Yankees going to take their free agency strategy, not free agency, trade deadline strategy. You know, what are the proper moves that they're going to have to make to be a World Series champion team to end the drought? And the one thing that you notice with anybody that's as new to the league as Ben Rice is, and granted, he's only been up for a couple weeks. Like, we're talking, this guy's been up for just short of a month. But you always know that the future of the younger players is the least predictable. The other thing that I don't want to take away from the Yankees celebration of what happened yesterday, but the other thing that's huge for a Ben Rice is if the Yankees do fall into a situation where they go into a win now strategy, whether it's end of this season, whether it's next season, and somebody gets prioritized over a player like a Ben Rice, performances like yesterday are the best sort of marketing for a young baseball player to make your case that, hey, if this isn't the city that I live and die in, that there will be another one out there that is. And I think that's something really cool, is to see a young player like that flourishing so quickly and having like a moment that people are talking about. There's no one that's saying, I mean, granted, people are saying it for fun because it's like whenever you see a player for your team do something good, you're like, that's my king. But like, no one is yet saying that Ben Rice is Babe Ruth. But at the same time, that's a game that turns heads. That's a game that turns people onto you, that makes people watch you going forward, that makes the more casual success that you have later on, that let's say maybe people who weren't turned on to your name originally because you had this highlight game are now staying woke for, staying up to date on, because they got put onto this freakish game you had against your biggest rival in front of a home crowd.
Yeah, I think a game like that is something that from the young guys is, you know, more so than I think probably any other team. The Yankee Stadium crowd, it can win games more so than any other place I've ever been. And so when you get a young guy like that, really getting the fans behind him in a stretch where the team has really been struggling, it really only takes one guy to get the fans on their feet, get the fans rallied behind them. And that will trickle down throughout the lineup, right? The fans love Soto. The fans love Judge. Now, if they get another guy, you know, everyone loves Volpe. Volpe sees another young guy hitting, and he's like, hey, I want in on that. And so it can really just one good game, really good game from anyone throughout the lineup, especially if it's not one of those top guys, can catalyze a lineup to just go on a tear. And you might see, you know, kind of a reverse of, you know, that historical Yankees, you know, after All-Star break slump, and maybe now going into the All-Star break and out of it, you know, they go on a tear and they're back to, you know, that 30-game over 500 that we saw earlier in the season.
Well, we'll start to get a step closer to figuring whether that is true or not tonight at 7:05, Yankees, Red Sox, ESPN Sunday Night Baseball. I will be there with Nick Palmer. We are both very, very excited to cover that one. It's going to be Cutter Crawford on the bump for the Boston Red Sox and Luis Gil for the New York Yankees, who he is very much looking to get a quality start after being one of the, you know, many small pieces of the Yankee struggles of the past 20 games or so. Let's hop on the subway. Let's get on the 7. Let's go to Queens, Citi Field, New York Mets, who I guess we can talk briefly about the month of June, the Grimace Mets, the Pride Month Mets. But, you know, a historic month for them. They were the best team in Major League Baseball record-wise for basically majority of the month of June. Trailing right behind them was actually the Houston Astros, Barrett. And then the Astros indeed. And then the Astros come into Citi Field and take 2 out of 3. So that must have felt pretty good for you. But anyway, this past week or so, you have seen a slightly more human New York Mets than we've been privy to seeing in this month. They lose a series to the Houston Astros, as I mentioned, on home turf. Houston takes 2 out of 3, gave up a lot of runs, lost 9-6 in the second game of the series, lost 10-5 in the third game of the series after a major rain delay and extra innings. Then they go down to D.C. They get a couple of gutsy wins, a lot of scoring in those first ones, 9-7, 7-2. And then they drop three and four of that series to the Washington Nationals, which hurts, especially because when you look at this highly congested National League wildcard race, which the Nationals are very much in, losing games, that's them picking up a full game on you. That's the same thing, you know, anytime the Yankees and the Red Sox face off, or the Orioles and the Yankees face off in those divisional runs. There's no half games when you're playing against a team in your division. If you lose to them, that's a full game. So they split 2-2 with the Washington Nationals, including a pretty abysmal showing on the 4th of July, where they lose 1-0 and get shut out and waste a fantastic 7 scoreless inning performance from Jose Quintana. Then they go to Pittsburgh, and this is where I kind of want to talk about July 5th. It's Friday night. 14-2 is the final in Pittsburgh. The Pirates only score via the home run. They hit 7 home runs, 2 of them from Rowdy Tellez, which was really funny. And, Lou, you said that Pittsburgh ran out of fireworks, correct?
They do the fireworks after every home run. They ran out of fireworks by the end of the game, which is that any indication how that game was going for the Mets. I think that tells you right there.
Very, very, very rough night to be a New York Met. But, hey, they bounce back the next day. They win 5-2 against a good Pirates team that's really kind of in the same position as the Mets, trying to stick around 500, trying to maybe once they get there, hopefully hang on to 500. But right now they're just a little under 500. But yesterday the Mets win 5-2. And I think what we saw in that game yesterday is the same thing that enabled them to have the success they've had in the month of June, which was the fact that top to bottom, the lineup has finally woken up. If you look at all 5 runs yesterday in this Mets victory, Luis Torrens with an RBI, a 3 RBI, a base clearing double. Jose Iglesias doubling one run double. Harrison Bader, sac fly. There, I did not list a single hitter that hits higher than about the 5 spot in that recap of that game. And I think one of the things that has really worked wonders for the Mets is when you watch the beginning of the season, and Lou, I'll hand this one off to you because I'll mention the game against the Yankees. You look at the beginning of the season where it felt like you never got a full team effort on any given night. It felt like one night the pitching shows up and the bats don't back them up. One night the bats show up and the bullpen explodes. One night the front half of the lineup's got it going on. One night the back half of the lineup has it going on. You are now seeing complete top-to-bottom hitting where the top 4, Lindor, Nimmo, Martinez, Alonso, are all hitting the way a top 4 of any baseball team's lineup should. But now you're seeing the bottom half of the lineup. You got, you know, Bader working kind of a double leadoff role. You got Mark Vientos and Francisco Alvarez, who have been one of the best statistically one of the best offensive duos in Major League Baseball with over a 900 OPS. You look at those sort of things. You look at the second game against the Yankees in that first installment of the Subway Series, where they score 11 runs, and I think it was 9 of them were batted in by the 5-9 spot in the order. You're finally seeing, I think, just like a batting order that is finally going to give you a chance to win baseball.
I think they found success with some of the substitutions they made in their lineup. Putting Vientos in there and letting him play every day is something I campaigned about a lot this season. You need to find out. You have a little freedom here to run guys like Beatty or Vientos, whichever way you want to go. They started out by giving Beatty run, and those at-bats started to get worse and worse as the season went along. So they give Vientos that spot, and he's run with it, so why would you switch it up? Calling up Jose Iglesias and watching him hit the way that he has in the bottom half of the lineup. Like, to me, those are the type of moves, that's the type of boost you get from the bottom of your lineup that changes the way your lineup's going to go 1-9. And so the same way that we said, like, the Yankees, you can't look at the month of June and just completely disregard it. I think it's the same thing with the Mets. I don't think they're the best team in baseball, but now you've seen them play at a high level for multiple stretches, and this last one was really long. I think you have to buy into it, and part of that, I think, is players either progressing or regressing to the mean. Lindor was not going to hit at a 600 OPS all year long. Jeff McNeil, that's maybe a different story, but he
took it Paul Skeens deep for some reason.
Who knows? Maybe that's the spark that changes his season. But like, when you look at the conversations people were having against Lindor, it's like sometimes you forget. Some people are slow starters. He does this every time. I'm not really surprised that once June comes around, Lindor starts to spark and he ends up hitting like this, or ends, you know, his stats end in a really good spot every season. So don't get tricked with a guy like Lindor. My big question now is, and we said this on 101 a little bit yesterday, like, how aggressively do you pursue the rest of the season? Because it's hard to disregard the fact that you were the best team for a month. That's a really long stretch of baseball. Not every team is going to be the best team in baseball for a month-long span. So that's how much weight do you put into this? Because the expectations for the Mets were not super high coming into the season. But now I'd say you've already exceeded them. How aggressively are you going to push through this deadline?
Yeah, and I think the Mets are, you know, as we mentioned earlier, they're a team I really think are in that same vein as the Astros, where you had two of your top guys in Lindor and Alonso really struggle to start the season. And, you know, now that they've picked it up and the whole team has started to pick it up, and you've got, you know, the pitching has been better, the hitting top to bottom, other than Jeff McNeil, who's still horrible, but has been better. You know, when you're getting, you know, good hitting from guys like Harrison Bader and, you know, even Luis Torrens, as, you know, your backup catcher is playing well, you know, I think that's signs of a team that maybe, you know, maybe they're not going to be the best team. You know, they're not going to win the division, but they're a team that can make some noise in the postseason, as we've seen from the National League. You know, the National League the last couple of years, it hasn't been the best team who's made the World Series. And so, you know, if they can turn it around, you know, they're floating around 500, make a couple, you know, you're not going to see the big splashes at the deadline from them, but, you know, they make the couple of the right pieces here and there, you know, get guys who can come in, you know, be impactful bats in small sample sizes. You could see them make some noise in the postseason, and I think that's kind of where they want to be. You know, they have the Grimace Mets, or, you know, Jack Warner's Pride Month Mets. You know, they have this identity behind them, and when you can come together and have an identity as a baseball team, you can make – you might not be the most talented, or you might not all be having the greatest seasons, but when you can piece together, you know, games here and there where everything comes together and you win the games you're supposed to, and you can fight against, you know, Pirates – this last series against the Pirates team was actually – quite decent. They had great pitching. You know, when they faced Skeens, they didn't pitch or play very well. But, you know, winning games you're supposed to. It's signs of a team who, while they might not be the best team in the league, like we saw in the last month, they are a team that can cause some problems for other teams and, you know, sneak into the playoffs and maybe make noise. So I don't think the Mets are the best team in the league, but I also don't think it's a season where Mets fans can say the season's lost and we're terrible and Jose Lindor needs to be – or Francisco Lindor. Jose Lindor, that's not a person. Francisco Lindor needs to be shipped off to Korea and never play a Major League Baseball game again. Like, it is a team that has talent and a team that can really be a fun watch for the rest of the season.
Random sidebar, was that a schnauzer, and what's his or her name? Because it was very cute. I saw it on your camera.
Yeah, that is a miniature schnauzer named Franklin.
I love it.
We are getting hit by a hurricane right now. So,
oh wow,
dogs are kind of losing their mind.
That's all good, man. No, but I do think that it really does pose an interesting question about how aggressive they need to be at the deadline, because I do think what they do at this year's trade deadline, to me, as I've learned from past years, indicates how they view this season will be. Because last season, if you remember, approaching the deadline, they were about, I think it was 16 and a half games. When I first started looking into it, they were around 16 and a half games out of the first place spot in the NL East. And on top of that, had two or three teams in front of them for the final wild card spot. There was still a chance. Oh, you know, if you put all your chips in and try to make some magic happen, you're not statistically out yet. But what do they do with the trade deadline? They invest in youth and they trade away Tommy Pham, who granted was brought in as a rental, but at the same time was statistically the best hitter in the lineup that season. And they traded him, which clearly showed you that that's how they're taking the rest of their season. They don't see anything coming of it. So why keep this guy? Yes, this guy is giving you great statistics, great numbers. For what? It's not going to win you anything. You might as well get him out, get some value for it, move forward. Now you're looking at a team who's flirting with the wild card and is getting closer and closer with the better baseball that they play. And now it's like, okay, how important do you view a strong team in the wild card? Because if they really view this season as a chance, if they embody the 2019 Washington Nationals, mm-hmm. you know, mentality of if they can do it, our team can do it, then they're going to want to beef up. And I don't think there's a way to be overly aggressive if that's your outlook. I guess there are some ways, but I'm saying that in a general sense, I guess I wouldn't be opposed to them being aggressive at the deadline and being a buyer. Now, at the same time, there's some big, you know, question marks coming up, especially with Pete Alonso heading into free agency this offseason. So there's also other questions to be answered where it really does leave you with an interesting thought process of how aggressive is too aggressive for this Mets team at the deadline.
Well, I think the last year comparison is interesting because I think most baseball fans would tell you last year's team on paper far better than this year's team. It's not even close. Last year's team had World Series aspirations.
Yeah.
This year's team has shown you more. So there's more incentive to buy into this year's team and a playoff run than there was last year, even if the standing spots might not be all that different. I, earlier in the season, was big on, hey, man, trade Martinez, trade Bader, you know, trade your rentals, see what you can get back. I've kind of flip-flopped on that. For me, now it's if you're not re-signing Alonso, I still don't know where they stand on that. If you think that you're re-signing Alonso, then you keep him and it's not even a question, whatever. You know, you keep this group together and you keep pushing. If in the back of your mind, you know, we're not giving Alonso $45 million a year, unless this team can win a World Series, I think you have to trade him. And even if you think that this team's ceiling is NLCS, I think you have to trade Alonso. The package you're going to get back from him is going to be big. I think even though you could get a good package back for Martinez, you could get a package for Bader, for Seve, those packages aren't tempting enough for me to give up on this team, which I now think is not only good enough to make the postseason, I think they can make a little bit of a run and maybe upset someone. I don't know if the ceiling is World Series. You have to be really special and you have to be really lucky to win a World Series or even to make, right? The Yankees haven't made one since 2009. They've had some really good teams. Part of it's just a crapshoot. To me, though, the package you're going to get for Pete Alonso, if it's not going to be Soto level, but it's going to be a team's top. They're probably a team's top pick or a top prospect and a guy that can change your franchise for the next 10 to 15 years.
So again, if you don't think you're winning the World Series and you think that you're not bringing Alonso back, then you have to do your due diligence and see if you can't get a haul. But everyone else, I keep as much of this group that I can together. And maybe even as even if you're trading Alonso, that doesn't mean you still can't make small adds.
Right.
It doesn't mean you can't make small buys and maybe bolster this bullpen, get another bat. You want to get another rotational piece, whatever you want to do. I've come around on that. Like, whatever they want to do to put themselves in position for a strong postseason run, at the end of the day, a good postseason run without a World Series, that's still valuable. I think it's still valuable for a fan base. It's when you get to, if we don't trade Alonso, we're missing out on a generational prospect, where I go, hey, man, that's 10, 15 years that you have sustained success potential.
Right. No, I mean, again, I think it comes down to if there's any big pieces that do need to be added. I think the consistency that you're finally seeing from the Mets lineup now, I don't think that your first thought necessarily means they need another fielder or another bat. Granted, there could be players available that sweeten the pot a little bit. Then great, if you want a depth piece, fine. I think Jeff McNeil, I agree with you, Barrett is not really who you'd want to be your ideal second baseman, but they have Jose Iglesias behind him, who they only play against lefties, but has been absolutely raking and is not showing his age at all. So I don't think my question marks approaching the deadline are at all lineup or defense related. It's the goddamn bullpen, which is right now paralyzed from some injuries. They finally get Edwin Diaz back from his sticky stuff suspension. That was a fun little alliteration there. But, I really think it comes down to you've seen enough from majority of their starters. Sean Manaea has been very good, you know, in his most recent starts. Severino has had a year that has really been considered much of a bounce back year for him. He still has had his ups and downs, but really in general has had a good season. You are seeing, David Peterson looked great during the New York series and has looked good since then. It really comes down to this injured bullpen that loses them games. I really don't think, there will be a game here and there where the bats go quiet. That's baseball. But there are games where they are in it. They are hitting the cover off the ball. There's games where, you get a great between 5 and 7 innings out of your starting pitcher. Because that's the other thing I've kind of appreciated about Mendoza this season is I think he's let his starters go deep. There's a lot of games where you're seeing Met starters not come out until a 6th inning or later if the game is going their way. So when you have starters that have done a nice job setting the table and you have an offense that has now started to produce in a way that not many other teams' offense has, it's the bullpen that's losing them games. And it's happened multiple times. It happened against your Astros when they go into extra innings after the rain delay and all hell breaks loose. It happened in the very beginning of the season when this team was a dumpster fire. I still joke about it to this day. Sean Manaea, Mets debut, 7 scoreless innings, goes into extra innings 0-0. And then Mike Tonkin gives up a 5 spot in the 10th inning to the Tigers. This bullpen has been one of the only things that has consistently lost the Mets games. And they do have some good bullpen pitchers. They're just not all healthy. I think the job that Adrian Hauser has done going from the starting rotation to the bullpen is really admirable. That's not an easy thing to do. It's a different job. There's different stakes involved. You enter the game in different scenarios. There have been some bright spots. But my point being is the only thing that I've really seen actually I can confidently say way down this team is the bullpen. Yeah, I think whether you want to see this as a good thing or a bad thing is that we're still a couple weeks away from the trade deadline. And so I think it'll, for the Mets especially, more so than the Yankees, is you'll really see a decision on what the Mets are going to have to do.
Right.
Take place over this next couple of weeks. Because, say they go, 7-10 over the next 2 weeks and something, and they're 7-8 games under 500 or whatever that would make. I think 6 games is what that would make them. Maybe they don't buy, but if they go 10-7 and they're 3 games over, with the way that the NL wild card, that puts them basically into the NL wild card spot. And so I do think the small moves, but also the tough thing is almost every contending team is also in that space of needing bullpen arms.
Yep.
And so I think that's a market this year that's going to be very competitive. And
the NL is congested.
Exactly. And so with that need for bullpen arms, you might see teams that you thought were going to sell end up not selling. And so that bullpen arm market is going to be very, very, it's going to be tightly contested. And so I think while you might need them, if the price is too high, I don't think you can't sell out for bullpen arms for a team that, as Lou said, you know, are they a World Series team? And so while they might be floating around, if they think that the bullpen is what's going to hold them back and they can't get that good arm, you might see a Mets team floating around that spot that trades Pete Alonso anyways, because if they think the bullpen's going to hold them back, then I think it's a better situation. They'll get the prospects and get ship Pete Alonso off, see what you got in the system, but also stay competitive with a mediocre bullpen that you have, which is something you see a lot of those fringe wildcard teams do year to year.
Well, I mean,
they sell without truly selling, right? You sell off the big names, keep everyone else, and you know, you buy the small pieces back, you sell the big names, and you try and stay right where you are and say, hey, if we luck into a wildcard spot, we luck into a wildcard spot.
This episode has reminded me just about why I think I've been in such a good mood watching baseball lately. And I think it's because this is as, you know, interesting of a baseball season I think we've had in New York City, not just in each respective team, but one of the most interesting seasons we've had in New York City in a while, between having a Mets team that started with nothing and has clawed their way back into being just short of a big time contender in the wild card race. You have a Yankees team that on paper is a World Series caliber team with a historic start to the season and a ungodly ridiculous year from Aaron Judge. And now they're in some rocky territory right now, trying to sort of rehash their season going forward, even though they're still like 20 games over 500. But I do think it's just been fun seeing all the different question marks that surround each team. The fact that both teams will have legitimate decisions to make at the trade deadline, obviously for different reasons. But that's going to basically do it for the New York portion. I really just have one other thing I want to touch on that is really cool, because we witnessed some history aside from Ben Rice, because that was Yankees history. This is MLB history. Jose Miranda of the Minnesota Twins ties an MLB record from 1952. The record, you ask, it is most consecutive at-bats with a hit. Now, I want to read this tweet from Jeff Passan just so we can audibly hear how ridiculous this is. The last 12 at-bats for Minnesota's Jose Miranda. Single, double, single, double, single, double, single, double, home run, single, single, single. His average has jumped from 294 to 329. Barrett, does this accomplishment, is it any less cool in your eyes because of who he did the majority of that hitting against?
I think it's significantly less cool because of who he did. But also, I think most impressive is that he did the harder half. You know, as you get later into that streak, it's harder because it's on your mind. He did the harder half against the best pitcher in baseball over the last month, Hunter Brown. And so, and he did it against an Astros team that's incredibly hot. And the fact that he did that, I think, is just kind of indicative of where the Twins are. Is they're a team that's going to battle. They're a team that's going to fight. And when you have Lin-Manuel Miranda's cousin able to do that, you know, in your order. And fun fact that
Lin-Manuel Miranda's cousin?
He is actually, yeah. So
that's awesome.
I always forget about
family.
And then
good God.
A couple years ago, he hit a couple home runs in a row, and everyone was like, oh my God, Lin-Manuel Miranda's cousin is good at baseball. But yeah, no, I do think, on a more serious note, I think that it's something, you know, playing baseball your whole life, it's something that you understand how hard it is to get three, four hits in a row. To do 12 at the highest level against some very good baseball teams, it's not like he did it against the A's pitching staff, right? He did that against some very good teams. And so, it's history for a reason. And I think it's incredibly cool. And it should get as much press as it deserves, because it's something that we probably won't see again.
I mean, I think it's just another another little tidbit of how fun the Minnesota Twins have been to watch this year. I mean, it's been so fun seeing that team be a legitimate contender this year and even have some more competitive years in the past couple seasons, but obviously not to the extent of the successes of this season. But you hit the nail right on the head. Just to see 12 consecutive at-bats, which if you think about it, in a normal offense, in a normal game, 27 outs, you're guaranteed three plate appearances. A lot of games you have between three and four plate appearances. So let's just say, you know, whatever. That's either four straight games going 3-for-3 or three straight games going 4-for-4. That's ridiculous. I mean, that is just full on. You worked through three different starters and three different bullpens, whether they're middle relievers, you know, end relievers, you know, closers, whatever the case may be. And you work through 12 different arms. Well, actually, technically not 12 different arms, but you know what I mean. You have to work through a bevy of pitchers to get to that point. It has to be one of the most impressive feats I've ever seen in my time.
I mean, the Astros even hit him one of those in between some of those hits just to try and slow him down, and it didn't work. So he was just on another world right over that stretch. It's something that's.
So, Barrett, what member of Fordham University Club Baseball is going to hit 12? Is it my money would be on Matt Benson, but
I think that's the only
like a Matt Benson thing.
But I also
think Matt Benson's the only option.
But I also could see a sneaky Tommy Savino loves his dinky base hits. Like he loves down the line. He likes shooting ones down the line. I think in the fall he hit like 600. So like,
I think he could know sneaky, Tommy Savino, sneaky. James Monaco maybe. James Monaco can get hot.
Yeah, that's true. He's
but,
a good
you know a Tommy Savino backside. 12 backside singles in a row might be actually the truth.
Oh my God. And you know, there'd be a couple like that just bleed through the whole, like,
they yeah, probably about 40 mile an hour exit velo that,
yeah, he gets an end, like half of them would be end caps
with those club baseball second basemen, you know,
exactly. Cause they're known to be cream of the crop defensemen in the sport of baseball.
Mm-hmm.
But on that note, cause I'm sure the listeners at home have no idea what any of that meant. We're
not Matt Benson.
That's true. That's true. Matt, big name. Matt, actually, that's true. Matt Benson.
All-time FUCB hits leader.
Yeah, exactly. That's El Presidente. That's going to wrap up today's episodes of Nosebleed. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. We will be back next week with whatever crew Lou Orlando decides should break down the baseball news from that week.
You don't want
that. Probably not that crew, to be honest, if this week is anything to go by. Probably a completely different crew than what is on the
I'll say it's a high bar that they're going to have to be able to top this week's pretty strong. I'll say so.
But signing off for Lou Orlando and Barrett Spritzer, I'm Jack Warner. We will see you next week. Mm-hmm.